a short four-letter word which is present everywhere, touching and impacting everything in society, data. I'm here to invite you into a journey to see a world that already exists within yours, that are collectively creating every day, sometimes without noticing. We want you to realize how powerful data truly is, to be aware of how data is shaping today and changing our future. Hi, I'm your host, Bianca Lopez. It's a pleasure to welcome you to this movement brought to you by HSBC. This is Voices of Data. Our goal, to unveil the data world, bringing you closer to understand and realize all the impacts of data and analytics in the transformation of our lives. To enrich the conversation, we'll bring you the coolest and brightest people out there. From markets to industry, we'll connect the data dots across the globe and let you know how data is shaping music, games, healthcare, education, and much more. All markets are stepping up their digital path, and data analysis helps them describe what's happening and understand the variables, diagnosing the reasons to improve predictions and possible results. So today, we are here with Ranel Bethaju, Global Head of Data and Analytics for Wealth and Personal Banking at HSBC. Hi, Ranel.
Hi, hello.
So today, I get to ask you a little bit more than the title, responsible for data and analytics at HSBC globally. So in a new world, there's a new generation. So one of the toughest things, I think, for me that have taught me a lot of experts is asking somebody to explain something if I was maybe a 10-year-old. So Voices of Data, first episode, I have to ask you, if you were explaining to a 5-year-old, what is data, Ranel?
Yeah, so look, I have a 13-year-old and a 12-year-old, and so I've had to explain to them, what do I do? And how I've done it is, so this is the conversation I had, right? So what I said was, I said this to my 11-year-old daughter, so this is about a year ago, right? What I said was, I'm going to time you for 60 seconds, so I'm just going to, you know, have a stopwatch, 60 seconds, and then I just, you know, timed 60 seconds. And then what I said to her was, right, what I want you to do is, reflect back on that 60 seconds. What did you see, right? So what noises did you hear? What temperature did you feel? What thoughts were in your head? What sensations did you feel? You know, were you hungry? Think about everything in that 1 minute, right? So that was 1 minute. And so we spoke about that 1 minute for about like 5 minutes as she replayed back everything that she could remember. Then what I said was, right, that's 1 minute. Imagine how if I asked you to do that for every single minute of your day, right? Imagine the vastness of information. And imagine if we had to do that for every single person every day for like forever, for infinity. Imagine that amount of data. And, you know, what I do is, what data is, it's really trying to understand all of that, all of those signals from everyone, from everything, forever. And then really use that to try and solve problems, try and, so firstly, how do we retrieve information? So you struggled with 1 minute of trying to remember. Imagine if I asked you, tell me about the minute 3 years ago. If we have data and it's organized, we can do that. We can go straight back to that. But then also we can solve problems. We can work out what things lead to what. If you like this, what do you like? You know, how are people connected? But also if you have all of that data, what can you do with it? And, you know, my kids had, they'd been learning about levers at school. So I think it's Aristotle, isn't it? Aristotle, who said, you know, if give me a lever and a fulcrum to put it and big enough and I can move the earth. And what I said to my kids, my daughter is, if you have enough data, if you've got all of it, you could pretty much predict anything, right? So it's a way to kind of use all of that to predict things. So that was kind of, it kind of made it a bit more interesting because I think, oh, that's, you know, what's daddy doing with, you know, with a computer. So it did bring it to life a bit. So that's kind of that's how I've been sort of really explaining it to the kiddies at home.
I love the explanation. What I got from it is that if I was to explain to a 10-year-old what is data, I'm going to say is
I'm going to teach them how to meditate for a minute, and I'm going to tell them how many stories or facts or things did you gather in that minute. I love that as a measurement of conceptual and teaching us how we can train our minds to realize this and what is the power of that collective intelligence we can harness. I think a part of this podcast is how do we share the stories and hear the voices? Tell us a little bit about what got you excited to do this.
Yeah, so let me just kind of pick up one of the points you raised, right? So if I think about my role, so I'm the global head of data and analytics for Wealth and Personal Bank. It's a very fancy kind of, you know, title. But the reality is, you know, what I want to do is I want to really transform banking and the bank that I work at with data and analytics. I want to completely transform how we do things. And to do that, it doesn't make sense to have me leading that as the global head of data. To actually achieve that, analytics, data, AI, machine, it has to be everyone's, right? I've got to make this something that is democratized and that there aren't the high priests of data in between solving problems, right? So my personal goal is, you know, I say this quite often, right? In say 3 years, there really shouldn't be a person like me in my role, right? So basically the thing that I do should be mainstream. I really believe that data analytics, these are going to be the core skills for any role, not just in banking, not just in telcos, in any role, it's going to be a core skill in the same way that typing is, right? So think about the world of, actually when I started, right? So in 1999, right? The company that I worked at, we actually had a typing pool and you'd send things to the typing pool and they'd type things up. Now typing is pervasive. Spreadsheeting is a separate department. It's pervasive, right? So my personal belief is a lot of what people like me do will become all pervasive skills that that everyone will need to have in their world of work. So there's a lot of work to do in terms of upskilling people. There's a lot of work to do to make a lot of these capabilities, you know, democratize, right? How do you make them self-serve? But that's the goal, is to make this everyone's capability. And it's something that everyone can use rather than having a group of boffins that are the intermediaries between, you know, kind of using this tech or not. That's my very strong view that, you know, it's going to be incredibly pervasive. And, you know, whenever I talk to my kids, I always encourage them to understand how to frame problems, how to think about data.
And we are talking about data. So tell us a little bit about you.
Right. Hey, so look, I grew up in Australia, and all the way growing up, I wanted to actually be a chemical engineer. Super bizarre thing to want to be as a teenager, but that, you know, that's what I wanted to do. And so I ended up going to university, studying that, and graduated as a chemical engineer and started work as one. And, you know, my first job was working in a nickel smelter in the middle of the desert in Western Australia. I loved it, but then I realized I'm a big city boy and cities make me tick and I need to move back to the city. So I quit my job, moved back to Sydney, and looked around for another job. And I was very fortunate that I got into a graduate program with ING. And at the time they were looking for people with, you know, quantitative skills, with lots of maths. And I thought, yeah, this is great. I'll try this out. And in my graduate rotation,
you literally went from the desert to being like, I'll just try this out.
Yes, to wearing went from like a hard hat and sort of, you know, kind of stained overalls to a sharp business suit. And
nice.
Yeah, like,
it's nice though, right?
It was actually. So I think that's the thing I really missed, right? So I realized, you know, I love the engineering work, but it was just, you know, kind of, I wanted to live in the city. But when I worked at ING, my first rotation was in marketing, and it was literally, it was like 1999. And it was when the first generation of data mining had just started. And my first project was a database marketing customer segmentation project. And I really loved it. It was just incredible. It was just this great opportunity to be at the nexus of applying mathematical skills, data, but then also solving real customer and staff problems. And I kind of got really hooked. And I actually ended up quitting the program and deciding that I want to be, I love this world of data mining, analytics, insights. I love this. And at that time, right, so this is 20 years ago, no one knew that data would take off. No one understood what it was. So I'd explain to my parents, look, I'm working this new field called data mining.
I don't think my parents know what I do still. Like, it's just kind of, okay.
So that's kind of how I got into it. And I just loved it, right? And, you know, I was just really fortunate that this thing that I got into right on the ground floor ended up just growing and growing. And, you know, what I really loved about it is, I feel it's, you know, it really stimulates me intellectually, but it's a way to solve problems using lots of data. And I've always really enjoyed that. So I've sort of really shaped my career over the last 20 years around that, being at the nexus of application of mathematics, data, and solving behaviors, you know, customer behaviors, staff problems. How do you solve that? So that's kind of how I really got into this space.
And changing one of the probably biggest catalysts since, well, the internet, if you ask me, or faster payments before its inception, data transformation. How is it changing such a large organization's culture effectively to depend on something that's a little bit human, a little bit something that most don't fully comprehend?
So I can sort of explain how it has changed in banking over the last 20 years, right? So, you know, I mentioned that, you know, I started in this space 20 years ago and we were literally in the basement. That's where, if you were doing data mining and data science, you were like literally working in a room with no windows. You were far away from the view. And then over the past 20 years, it's gone from basement to seeing as a, you know, like a really great sort of service function, to a support function, to an enabler, to over the last 5 years, right? Many organizations competing based on data and analytics. So it's been a huge shift. And if I think about me personally, I've gone from literally the basement to now being on all of the ExCos and Mancos, and seeing my team now actually being a core part of all of the leadership team. So that's been the shift, in that, you know, everyone recognizes that data and analytics, it's actually a core driver of competition. However, it is still very new. It's a new technology. And, you know, I think many organizations are still really working through, how do you make it something that's going to give us an incremental difference to how do we actually reimagine our core business using this capability? And that's really where banking is.
It's how we almost like look back at the puzzle and go like, is the equation even right?
Exactly.
Is my thesis even right? We really
right.
take a culture.
Are we asking the right question?
Experimentation. And I think that's one of the biggest things that
yes.
most innovation departments have gotten wrong, is that they thought is like, I have to come up with the one solution versus sort of, you know, take a lesson from the book of some first principles thinking, is like, what am I trying to solve? How many more data points do I have now to tell that story versus what I had in the past? Truly transformational.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, for me, it's been, you know, this kind of thing about, you could use data analytics and AI and machine learning to do what you do today better, right? You could absolutely, right? It drives a tremendous increment. Or you could think about, why don't I reimagine what I'm doing using this as the core filter and the core lens? And, you know, I think banks are at that point, many organizations are at the point where they're trying to reimagine their business using these capabilities as a core driver of change.
What's your relationship with data and apps on a personal level, Renil?
Do you know, on a personal level? So I'm quite a big music fan. Like, I had a few genres. So I was into, you know, I grew up in the, you know, my kind of, you know, 90s grunge, you know, I was into heavy metal. But look, I then got into like, you know, kind of electronic music, but I kind of realized, you know, my kind of music taste was somewhat narrow. And then about maybe 12 years ago, I got into like streaming services. And one of the ones that was one of the early ones, it was called Last FM. It was one of the early pioneers. And they had one of the first algorithms, you know, that actually suggests music for you. And one of the things that...
Isn't it lovely when they get it right?
It's amazing, right? So, and, you know, because I'm a nerd, right? So I really like to understand and try and guess what sort of algorithm is it? Is it collaborative filtering? Is it content-based filtering? Is it demographic? There's different algorithms they use, right? But the one that Last.fm used, what I loved about it was the algorithm changed my music taste. Basically, it would occasionally throw up wildcards. So hip hop, really got into that. Really got into Ethiopian jazz. Like, you know, where did that come from? Bluegrass. All sorts of like music genres that were just kind of just out there. So that was one that really worked for me.
Do you see that as like, it expands my horizon?
Absolutely.
Like that's
absolutely.
What the value is on that growth?
Absolutely. So that worked really well, right? And then, so I was very positive about that. And I was, you know, and then about maybe 5 or 6 years, 5 years ago, actually. So what I realized at the time was actually my news media, the algorithms are overfitting, right? It's basically showing me the same stuff and I'm in this little bubble. Mm-hmm. And what I realized back then was I need to really broaden my media taste. And so since 2016, I've actually been consuming a very broad range of media. And I realized actually, whilst...
Men can form your own opinion.
Yeah, so just get a really broad view. I don't want the algorithms mm-hmm. to kind of overfit. So that's something I'm very, very conscious of.
And I think that's a huge part of why we're creating Voices of Data, right? To shed light, to bring transparency and talk about things like, what is the weight of the power this technology holds? Like anything in life, it comes with its consequences. And one of the things that I'm super excited to talk about is when you think machines don't really have prejudice, they don't really have inherent biases other than the ones that we bestow upon them by the people working in this area, in this field. And I think that brings us an opportunity. And what do you think is like the role? Like, do you see it as optimistically as me, perhaps, that data has a chance of rewriting some things?
Yeah. So look, I've ethics has been a huge focus for people like me over the last 3 or 4 years, right? So since all those big scandals in 2016 and 17, like Cambridge Analytica, Facebook, all of that stuff, right? Everyone now pays a lot of attention to ethics. And, you know, if I think about, the algorithms that people build, right? There's really sort of 3 ways that biases can be introduced. So the first and the really obvious one that, data scientists and data nerds and analysts have been looking at for years is the biases in the actual model, right? So how you've actually built the model, have you built it in such a way that there are model-based biases? So that's one that everyone's kind of been very conscious of for many years.
And isn't it great? Because you guys take such an experimental approach to it that is not about some powerful fight about who's right or wrong. It's about, okay, we learned this about this. We throw this out. We continue with that one.
Yep.
And it's like that continuous yep. thing.
So there's some methodological kind of biases, right? But the next two are sort of the ones that are a bit more insidious that I've really come to light, right? So one of them is there are definitely biases in the underlying data, right? So the underlying data set that you build a model on will actually reflect historical biases. So for example, how you choose to approve someone for a loan will depend on the history of how you've approved that before. And if there've been historical, kind of biases against ethnic groups or yeah, genders or sexual minorities.
Humans, yeah.
Absolutely.
They weren't considered citizens and couldn't borrow, for sure.
That will be reflected. So step one is you need to really understand that, right? And then the second bias that's, also quite interesting is, and it's one that doesn't get a lot of mention though, is building algorithms is basically, it's an art and a science, right? So basically it's not just about following a cookie cutter set of statistics. You have a lot of choices to make around which data you use, how do you choose features. So what that means is the actual data scientists themselves can introduce a lot of bias. So if you don't have a diverse group of people building your models, you will perpetuate biases. And therefore, in addition to understanding the model bias, the data bias, you've also got to have a very clear view on, do you have any biases in the people actually building the models? Do you actually have, so I'll give you an example, right? So when I worked for a different bank some years ago, one of the things that we had to do was come up with a way of identifying who was a primary banking customer. So it wasn't a model, it was more of an analytics exercise. So it's really trying to work out, is this customer primary banked? And historically, The way that the bank that I worked at had done that was to look at, do you have a salary credit going into your account? If you do, you're primary bank. If you don't, you're not. And what that kind of really failed to understand is there are many people that don't have a salary in their account, right? So housewives, people that have taken a career break who still are primary banked with you, but the old definition didn't really reflect that. So we had in our team a female analyst. And she pointed that out and said, well, this is really unfair. And immediately it was, oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. But it was a really, an early example of actually, you need to have diversity in your data science and analytics team such that you can even spot these things, even understand the biases in the data. So I feel that's equally as important as understanding sample bias in data.
That's amazing. And I think that you touched on two things. I think that's why communication becomes so important on being able to build that culture to call out and have those difficult conversations that just proves to us that all of these machines are going to require a lot of human and a lot of us thinking and understanding, because we're talking about societal issues that talk about what is the future that we are going to design as we compose this new world.
Yes.
Rinelle, it was a pleasure interviewing and talking to you today. This was really an exchange, and thank you for sharing the stories that need to be shared so we build a world where AI is for all.
Thank you, Bianca. I really enjoyed this.